Welcome to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randall. Dive into the live courtroom drama as we bring you unfiltered audio from one of the most riveting trials of the year. Accused of multiple marital murders, Randall's fate unfolds before us. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. This is Dark Vows.
The brief moments of laughter and levity that we had during jury selection are over. We're about to see some of those very serious photographs we talked about, and we're going to hear about some really serious things. Because after all, ladies and gentlemen, this is a murder case. And make no mistake, you're going to hear evidence about a murder. And you're going to hear evidence about the murderer who committed that murder. You will hear convincing, overwhelming, uncontroverted evidence about the man who committed that murder, about who he murdered, and why he did it. We're going to learn that on May 8th of 2008, that man, that murderer, entered the home of a married couple, husband and wife. And he did so with the intent to steal their earthly possessions. And when the wife, in that husband and wife relationship, came home just a little bit too early and surprised him in the act, that man, that murderer, took a .38 caliber revolver loaded with high-velocity plus P rounds, and he leveled it directly at her unknowing, unwitting, unaware head. And then he pulled the trigger, and he buried a bullet into that woman's skull. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what you will hear during this trial. But that man, that murderer, is not Thomas Randall. That man, that murderer, won't be in this courtroom. You will hear evidence about the man, the murderer, that committed that unthinkable, unbelievable, unfathomable act. That man, ladies and gentlemen, is Mike Miller. Centuries ago, the philosopher Marcus Aurelius said these words: "Everything we hear is an opinion, not a fact. And everything we see is a perspective, not the truth." So what is the truth about what really happened on May 8th of 2008? What really happened? And what will the evidence really show? Well, here's what we're going to learn. We're going to learn about Thomas Randall, or as Mr. Oram and I and most of his friends call him, Tommy. Spells it a little bit different. And Tommy, you'll learn, is a little bit different. But in 2008, he was married to Sharon. They had married in a ceremony abroad. They'd gone to Cancun in 2006 in the month of March, and they got married. And then they had a formal ceremony in Las Vegas a year later in March of 2007. You'll hear a lot from Tommy during this trial. The state showed you a number of interviews that he gives when he's cooperating with law enforcement. You're going to find out that Tommy is kind of brash. In fact, in one of those interviews, he describes himself, among other things, as cocky. And you're going to learn, and you saw a little bit of it in those blurbs that Mr. Hamner picked and chose to show you, that he uses colorful language. But here's what you'll learn. He uses that language with everyone, including Sharon. Tommy is as Tommy is. That's the ABCs of Tommy. And when asked by law enforcement to describe his wife, who he loved deeply, he didn't just say, "She's great, I love her, she's my wife." He said, "She's fucking wonderful." That's just the way he talks. And it's important to know that, because he talks that way the same to law enforcement as he does to his friends and his family and his wife in their own personal relationship. On May 8th of 2008, they were scheduled to have a date night. And despite the way the state would describe this as a very tumultuous relationship, you'll learn they had their ups and downs. But on that night, they had a nice night, at least at the beginning. See, Sharon and Tommy went to the Santa Fe Casino. They had spent a lot of time there. In 2005, they opened a movie theater in the Santa Fe, and Tommy and Sharon liked to go to the movies. They also liked to go out to eat. That evening, they went to a steakhouse called the Charcoal Room. It was Mother's Day around that weekend. So Sharon had been taken to the Santa Fe station to that special dinner to have steak and lobster. And they had a good time at dinner. We're going to learn that they originally intended to go to dinner and a movie. They love to go to the movies. In fact, in some of the crime scene photos, you'll see the enormous collection of DVDs. Back before we streamed everything on Netflix and Amazon, people actually had movies in their house, and they had hundreds of them. On that night, as they left dinner, we're going to learn that they decided to change their plans. They wanted to go home early because they had had such a good time. And you'll see video evidence of them leaving the Santa Fe hand in hand, not fighting, not arguing, but having a good time and being affectionate with one another. What they didn't know and what they couldn't know is as they strolled hand in hand through that parking lot, what Mike Miller was doing. So who's Mike Miller? Well, the state told you from their perspective who they want you to think Mike Miller is, but here's what the evidence is going to show. That he had met Tommy Randolph. Law enforcement's actually going to tell you that they had met prior to February, way back in December of 2007, and they met when Tommy extended an act of kindness to Mike Miller. And they became friends. And from the state's perspective, they can describe that as weird, but Tommy befriended someone who was down on his luck. And he didn't just have him do odd jobs. He did those. You'll learn that. The state describes this roof project that never got finished. It did. You'll hear evidence of that. He performed odd jobs not only for Tommy Randolph and Sharon, but for other people in their family as well. And they spent a lot of time together. We're going to learn that they communicated a lot. The state's going to show you that evidence. Remember, this is 2008. Most of us hadn't even heard of an iPhone yet. They'd just been invented the year before, and people weren't text messaging all the time. They talked on the phone, very brief conversations. Tommy was kind to Mike Miller. On May 8th of 2008, Mr. Miller had learned a lot of information about Tommy Randolph. And on May 8th, he used it to his advantage. And he did so to take advantage of Tommy and Sharon. To steal from them. See, here's what Mike Miller knew on May 8th of 2008. The evidence is going to show you this. He knew there were valuables in the Randolph home. They had jewelry. You're going to see a lot of jewelry that belonged to Sharon Randolph. They had cash. We're going to hear evidence, and we're going to learn that on May 8th, Tommy had been to a bank and taken money out. He had a lot of cash, and he intended to deposit it into a different bank on that day. But he didn't make it to the bank before it closed. So he had that cash in the house that day, and it was only going to be there that day. You're going to learn, we're going to see a lot of photographs, that there was prescription medication. Mr. Randolph has a number of physical ailments. You'll see evidence of it. You'll see him in the courtroom as he moves. You'll see him on the video as he moves. He has a lot of physical pain, and he was prescribed a number of medications that to him are necessary for his health, but to Michael Miller are valuable to sell on the street. We'll also learn that there were guns in that house. Some that belonged to Tommy, and some that belonged to Sharon. But we're going to learn that Michael Miller knew exactly where all of those valuables were kept, because he had been invited into that home. And he knew on that evening that Tommy and Sharon would be out of the house. See, he was with Tommy when he was discussing his date night plans. He knew that they were going to go to dinner and a movie. He'd heard all about it. Tommy had dropped him off right before he went home to pick up Sharon. So that was Mike Miller's motive that night, to take what didn't belong to him. And the timing was, it had to be that night. Because he knows Tommy's late to pick up Sharon, and he knows they're going to be out for several hours, at dinner, in a movie. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know he's got a stretch of time to get in the house, get what he wants, and get out. So Mike Miller's dropped off by Tommy. He makes his way back to the Randolph home, knowing they won't be home, and he gets inside. As I mentioned, Tommy and Sharon decide to come home early. They decided to skip the movie. And we're going to learn exactly why that was. See, in everybody's personal life, when they have a significant other, there are times when those people desire to be alone and intimate. And they probably talk in a way that you wouldn't talk in front of other people. We're going to hear evidence that that night, Tommy and Sharon were going home to be alone, to be intimate together. And we're going to hear it described in the unique way that Tommy and Sharon talked. What they didn't know is what would happen when they got there. So they pulled into the driveway. This is a photograph obviously taken after the homicides. There's crime scene tape up, but you can see the cars as they're parked in the garage. Tommy's car on the left, and Sharon's SUV on the right. You can see that in that garage, there's not a lot of extra space. So as Tommy desired to pull in, he had to, as many of us probably do, let Sharon out in the driveway. She walked inside. You can see that there wouldn't be room for Sharon to get out on the side if he hadn't done that. So he pulls in the garage, and then he walks inside the house. This is where the events happen that cause us to be in this courtroom, at least in part. What we're going to learn is that when Thomas Randolph opens the door, we're going to learn that it's after a few minutes. One of the things that we'll know at the conclusion of this trial is that Tommy Randolph loved rock and roll music. Saw pictures of him with long hair. Almost always had really long hair. Loved 70s rock music. Listened to it all the time. In fact, some of the most memorable dates that Sharon and Tommy had were going to rock concerts. He pulled the car in and he listened to a song finish on the radio. And then he walked inside. As he opened the door, he sees Sharon lying at the end of that hallway. He calls out to her. At first he thinks she's fallen. And he props the door open. As he walks inside, it dawns on him that she's actually hurt. She's not moving. And he sees something at the far end of the hallway. He's scared. Tommy has a firearm in the house. To the left, there's a bedroom. There's a closet. And he keeps a handgun, a small handgun, with some magazines in there. He calls them clips. And he takes those, and he waits for a second. And as he goes to look out, there's a confrontation in the hallway. Happens very quickly. He runs into someone, and you'll see him describe it on video. You'll see him try to remember exact details of things that would be impossible for anyone to remember in that situation. He describes physically running into each other, and in fact, Tommy's lip is cut. And he reports that to law enforcement later that night. There's some space made, and make no mistake about it, at some point, Tommy Randolph shoots that gun at the intruder who has murdered his wife in a brutal fashion in their own home. He follows him towards the door, and he shoots. He doesn't know how many times he shoots. Most people in that situation don't, as we'll learn during this trial. Until the intruder falls just outside the door. At some point, when they collide, the mask that the intruder is wearing is pushed up so that he can't see. And as we'll learn, by the time he gets outside, that mask is off. We're going to know what happens after that because we're going to hear evidence during this trial. Eventually, Mr. Randolph comes back inside and he looks for a telephone. He wants to call 911.
Some of the younger folks in this jury panel might not realize this, but there was a time that everyone had a phone in their house. He goes to get his cell phone. I mean, his house phone. And he picks it up. At the time, there was a subscriber by the name of Vine. Some of you may remember. That service was kind of the gap between old school landlines and the cell phones we use today. And sometimes that service would go out. Tommy picks up the phone and he dials 911. There's nothing there. He tries again. He begins to look for his wife's cell phone, continuing to dial 911. The third or fourth time he tries, the phone rings. And you're going to hear that phone call during this trial. And you're going to find that as Tommy attempts to perform CPR on his wife, it's a lost cause. That is a brutal injury that Mike Miller inflicted on her. And there's no coming back from it. But he tries. And there on her legs, when law enforcement arrives, is that telephone. And you'll be able to see the 911 that he had dialed and the inadvertent pressing during that process of the number 4. That's what gets law enforcement to the house. What's interesting is the state points out this inconsistency that he said he didn't hear or that he didn't know that there had been shooting in the house when he walked inside because he didn't hear anything, but then on the 911 call he says shots. He does say that. He says, all I hear is shots, 5 of them, which ultimately we will learn are the shots that he shoots. That's all he heard. He didn't hear the one fatal shot that killed his wife. So that's the evidence. Sharon was murdered. Mike Miller murdered her. How about the why? Well, you're not going to have any doubt in your mind at the conclusion of this trial why this murder takes place, because the evidence is overwhelming. Just outside the door, exactly where you would expect him to be if he was shot and killed by Tommy Randolph, exactly as Tommy described, you will see the body of Mike Miller. His feet are just outside that door. Next to his feet are a couple items of evidence. We're going to talk about those in just a second. But one thing we're going to learn is that when someone's killed in a homicide, they're taken to the coroner's office, and there's a thing called an autopsy that's performed, where a medical examiner determines the cause and manner of a person's death. When that's done, their clothing is removed and inventoried, and you'll see what Mike Miller was wearing on May 8th. You'll also see what's in his pockets. In his pockets, you'd see things that you would expect to be in Mike Miller's pockets. Matches, lotion, pocket change. But you'll see something else. In his left front jeans pocket is a ring. A lady's ring. It's called an eternity ring with channel set diamonds. It ain't his, but you'll know exactly where it came from. In his back pocket on the left-hand side is his wallet. In that wallet, you see things that you would expect to see. His ID, his social security card, membership cards with his name on it. But you'll also see something that you wouldn't expect to see. There's an ID in his pocket under the name, same first name, Michael. But it doesn't take a genius to see that's not Mike Miller. You'll also see in his pocket, bearing the same name of Michael Hogue on the driver's license, a Golden State Advantage card. You will learn during this trial that that's an EBT card, a food stamp card, ironically titled Golden State Advantage, in the pocket of the person who was taking advantage of the Randolphs. We'll also learn something very interesting that'll be telling about exactly what transpired in this case. See, as he lays on that garage floor, no longer with us, Mike Miller is still telling us what he was doing there. Because on his body are gloves. In May, in Las Vegas, you do not need to wear gloves unless you're working in the garden. Mike Miller was attempting to take home a bountiful harvest that night, but it wasn't flowers and it wasn't vegetables. He's wearing gloves in that house for a reason. And I want you to pay attention to something else in this photograph. If you look just above the right hand of Mike Miller, you'll see something on his wrist. We're going to learn during this trial what that is. And you'll find out that that's something that's used by emergency medical responders as they're there trying to resuscitate him. That'll be important in this case, as will those gloves. Because we'll know at the conclusion of this trial exactly where those gloves came from and exactly why they're on his hand. We're also going to hear about this ski mask that the state brought up in their opening statement. It's going to be crucially important in this case, not for the reasons that Mr. Hamlin told you. This ski mask is an unusual one. First of all, there aren't a lot of ski masks in Las Vegas, but this one has something rather unique about it. It has an exceptionally large mouth opening. So when you see it in evidence during this trial, you'll see it's been sewn shut with something that resembles fishing line. That's going to be important, because at the conclusion of this trial, we're going to know why Mike Miller had that, and we're going to know exactly what that mask was for. Now let's get back to this evidence I mentioned at his feet. There's two bags. One is like a plastic grocery-style bag. The other is also made from plastic, but it almost appears like a black-colored fabric. Those are both grocery bags from the biggest retail store in the world, Walmart. Inside and around those grocery bags is the answer to the question of why Mike Miller was there. Because you'll see in those bags and strewn about them after he had fallen to the ground trying to escape, after killing Sharon Randolph, all of Sharon Randolph's jewelry stuffed into those bags and in and around them where they had fallen to the ground as he lay there dying. Inside those bags, law enforcement does a search and they pull out not a little bit, but a lot of it, of jewelry. Lots of it. They spread it out and they photograph it. The state would have you believe during this trial that this is what the detectives refer to as cosmetic jewelry. You'll actually learn that some of that jewelry is quite valuable and that Mike Miller knew that. You'll be able to look at those photographs at the conclusion of this trial and you can determine for yourselves what that's made out of, what you think it's worth, what you believe from your perspective about that jewelry. What you can't do, though, is actually look at it, because law enforcement never impounded it, they never tested it, they never had it appraised, because it didn't fit their perspective of the case. But there will be no doubt in your minds about who had those bags and who placed them there, because you're going to hear from a witness that cannot lie, cannot change their story, and doesn't have a motive. You're going to hear from a little witness called Science that on those two bags, there is overwhelming evidence that Mike Miller had those bags. See, the bag on the right, that's actually Mike Miller's bag that he brought into the home. And we're going to know that because it's got his DNA in it. But it's also got something else. Before he puts on his gloves, he leaves a fingerprint on that bag. The bag on the left, that's actually Tommy Randolph's bag. But even though it's Tommy's bag, we're going to know who carried out that door, because that bag also has Mike Miller's DNA on it. So let's go inside the Randolph home, someplace the state didn't really take you, because it doesn't fit the perspective of this conspiracy theory they have. This home is ransacked. You will see inside the house there are drawers left open. Not all of them, just the ones where valuables are kept. And you'll see strewn about the house where Sharon had kept her jewelry. See that little heart-shaped jewelry holder? You'll see the drawers in the bedrooms open. You'll see a jewelry box tossed into a clothes basket in the closet. And you'll see her jewelry box thrown on the bedroom floor. That's the evidence. That's the evidence that someone who knew exactly where the valuables were kept had gone into that house and got stopped before they could get away. So what happens? Why are we here? I'm going to tell you why. The state mentioned the crime scene a little bit. They kind of looped over some of the important stuff, though. This is the scene. You'll notice a couple things about this picture. Crime scene tape up, like you've probably seen on television. And there's a patrol officer in uniform on the left-hand side of that photograph, responsible for putting up the crime tape and
kind of monitoring the border there. Inside the crime scene tape, so inside the crime scene, you see two individuals. The one on the left is a guy by the name of Lou Roberts. He was a homicide lieutenant. He's now retired. The guy in the middle, next to Tommy Randolph's car, is a detective by the name of Dino Kelly. You're going to hear from him during this trial. And you're going to hear from his perspective what this evidence means. Crime scene analysts are ultimately called to that scene. And Mr. Handler showed you this same diagram. Here's what is on the diagram, and then I'm going to talk to you about the diagram. In the top left-hand corner, you're going to see an event number. That's the number that the LVMPD assigns to this particular call. You're going to see the date, the address where it occurs, 6517 Rancho Santa Fe. You're going to see the personnel number. That's the initials and the ID number of the crime scene analyst who prepared this diagram. And you'll see the names of the two decedents, Sharon Randolph and Michael Miller. In the middle of this diagram, well, let me just start here. The purpose of the diagram, you will learn, is to document, collect, and preserve accurately what happens in a crime scene. Why? Because we can't come into court and make representations about it unless we know exactly where things were and how they were found. In this particular case, there were three crime scene analysts that were called. One is a woman by the name of Chelsea Collins. She's a crime scene analyst in the top there at number one on the left. I don't know if she'll be called during this trial. The second one is a crime scene analyst, senior crime scene analyst, by the name of Jeff Smith. I expect that the state will call him during this trial. The third one is a crime scene analyst supervisor by the name of Gary Reed. The state will not call him during this trial. On this diagram created by Ms. Collins, you will see what we call a legend. It's a numeric listing of everything of importance that's in that scene. It's not just the bodies that Mr. Handler showed you, but it's also the evidence. We should not have an expectation, ladies and gentlemen, that crime scene analysts will be perfect. But in cases like this, we should have an expectation that crime scene analysts can at least count to 10. If you count the numbered items in that diagram, you will see 1, 2, 3 cartridge cases. That's going to be important. You'll see a receipt from their dinner, a knife on the kitchen table, not one but two bullets. Remember, the state told you they found four in the garage. You'll see the mask and a hat. You'll notice that nowhere on the diagram and not within the legend are the numbers 10, 11, 12, and 13. That's going to be important. You'll see 14 and 15 following that. The reason this is important is because the state is going to tell you during this trial that those shell cases, they're not called casings. The casing is what goes around the outside of a sausage. A case, a shell case, is what's left behind when you shoot a gun. And the state's going to use that critical piece of evidence to have you see the case from their perspective. You'll see there's one shell case, two shell case, third shell case directly in front of the door. What you'll learn is those shell cases are exactly where you would expect them to be if this shooting happened like Tommy Randolph described. What's really interesting, though, is we're going to find out during this trial that law enforcement makes up their mind that night. They make decisions that very evening about Tommy Randolph, and it's on the evidence that they perceive that night at that crime scene. Remember, there's four bullets, but only three cases. We will learn that the shell cases are very important. And we will learn the problem with that evidence that the state just described to you. Here's a problem. See, there's a lot of people at that scene. It's not just those two detectives and those three crime scene analysts. At that scene, there are not one, not two, not three, but 10 patrol officers and three supervisors, two sergeants and a lieutenant. Being able to count to 10, I can tell you that's 13 people. There are canine officers, three of them, three violent crimes detectives. We will learn back in 2008 when there was a shooting call where somebody died, violent crimes detectives would respond to the scene before homicide. They would walk the scene. They'd make decisions about it. They'd interview witnesses. They'd document evidence, and then they would brief homicide detectives when they arrived. It wasn't just Dino Kelly. There were four homicide detectives, Ken Hardy, Cliff Mogg, Dan Long, Dino Kelly. I expect you will hear from two of them during this trial.
There was also a sergeant on scene by the name of Rocky Albee.
You will not hear from him because, like Gary Reed, may he rest in peace, he is no longer with us. And Lieutenant Lou Roberts, who I mentioned a moment ago.
There were the three crime scene analysts in and around the crime scene. There were also coroner's investigators. We'll hear evidence about that. Mortuary personnel, and then those first responders, paramedics, who are directly in the middle of that crime scene attempting to perform life-saving techniques. Right in that crime scene, three of them. We're also going to hear evidence about guns. This piece of evidence is going to be absolutely critical for you to understand what happened and how it happened, just like Tommy Randolph described. When law enforcement shows up, they're going to see folded down in one of the bedrooms, it looks like almost a little drawer. But when you flip it up, you realize it's a clock. But the purpose of that clock isn't just to tell time. It's also a place to keep a firearm. It's a gun safe compartment. And you'll know that because you'll see photographs during trial that says set gun upside down in the tray. When law enforcement arrives, it's actually flipped down. It's open. When they flip it back up to take photos of it, you'll notice it'll be easier to see in the actual photographs, but if you look on that wall directly around the clock, you're going to see a different color of paint. That's going to be important to you. Because you see, Mike Miller was aware that that room needed to be repainted because he was the handyman for the Randolphs. And he knew what was kept in that clock. That's going to be important for your consideration. Let's talk about guns. It's not just one. There's three guns recovered at the scene. One of them is going to be the gun Tommy used to save his own life and to take Mike Miller's. It's kind of an unusual gun. It's called a 9mm Makarov. That's the caliber of the gun, not the make and model. Most of us have probably heard of a 9mm. It's a very common cartridge. That cartridge is a 9x19. This is a different type of caliber. It's a slightly more, well, it's shorter, it's a little thicker, and it shoots a much lower velocity shot than a typical 9mm you may have heard of. This particular magazine holds 8 rounds, with one in the chamber, meaning the capacity of that gun, as fully loaded, is 9 rounds. Remember, Tommy Randolph says he didn't know how many rounds he fired. There's going to be 3 left in the gun, one up above it that was in the chamber. We're going to know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that he fired that gun 5 times. But there's 2 other guns recovered at the scene. They're called revolvers. It's a different kind of gun. Has kind of a wheel in it like you might have seen in the old cowboy movies. Those guns are documented on the crime scene diagram. And this is going to be really important at the conclusion of this trial. 14 and 15 are those 2 revolvers. 14 is discovered in the northeast bedroom office. You'll see it's right next to a trash can on top of some clothes on top of a suitcase. That's going to be really important for you during this trial, and here's why. On the 911 call, you will learn that Tommy Randolph actually goes outside and takes that gun from Mike Miller's person. And as he comes back into the house, he tries to throw it in that trash can. Because the 911 operator tells him, get the gun, put it someplace safe, lock the door. So he does. When police open that gun, they're going to discover that that's a .22 caliber, very small shell case. It's a rimfire cartridge. When you shoot, there would be a marking on the outside of one of those shell cases. You'll notice that all 6 of them are pristine. That gun has not been fired. That gun is the gun that Mike Miller had with him when Tommy Randolph confronted him. All of the bullets in those shells are still in that gun. Interestingly, however, in the east bedroom, next to the wall, there's another gun. That gun is also a revolver, and it looks very similar, but it's different. It's a .38 caliber revolver. It's called a centerfire cartridge. Those little circles in each one of the cartridges is where the primer is kept. When the gun is fired, the hammer comes forward, firing pin punches the primer, and it expels the actual bullet out the end of the gun.
This is a much larger round than a 22. These are what are called plus P rounds. They're designed with more pressure to create more velocity. You'll notice at the 11 o'clock position, that gun has been fired. That is the gun that Mike Miller chose to kill Sharon Randolph with. That is the gun that came out of the clock on the wall, exactly where Mike Miller knew it was. So law enforcement responds. These detectives will tell you that that very night, they developed a gut feeling about Tommy Randolph. The problem with a gut feeling, we'll learn, is it impacts your ability to see things from an open perspective. They have a feeling that night that Tommy's to blame somehow. Law enforcement's already made up their minds and decided Tommy's involved when they do this walkthrough. Now, this is the first screen you'll see when that walkthrough video is played during this trial. I expect the state to play it. It'll last about an hour. That walkthrough is an extremely unusual thing. Here's why. It happens a full week later. The crime scene has changed dramatically. It's been cleaned up. It hasn't been sealed. Number of people in and out of it. The LVMPD have Mr. Randolph come back to the address, and they do a walkthrough with him. And they record it. And then they go over and over and over again, trying to get him to say little minute details that it is an impossibility for any human to remember. In fact, we'll learn that law enforcement, when they utilize their weapons in the field, they never do a recorded walkthrough like this. And the reason is because it's impossible to recreate that dynamic, pressure-filled event in real time. But you're not going to have to take my word for that. You're going to hear from a witness during this trial named Jeremy Stafford. He's an expert witness. The defense is going to call him. And he's an expert in the use of force. He's got a very long resume that allows him to be an expert in that field. He was a United States Marine Corps veteran, and in fact, you'll learn that he was awarded the Bronze Star for valor in battle in a situation where he had to utilize his own weapon to save his life and the life of others. What'll be interesting about that is he's going to talk to you about the science behind what happens to the body and mind when you're put in that situation. I'm going to give you great detail and cite scientific studies, but he's also going to be able to tell you that from his own perspective, because he's lived through these events where it is impossible to recall every detail. He also worked for the LAPD, retired from there. He was their firearm subject matter expert for the whole LAPD, and he is the handgun editor for the largest magazine in the world dealing with firearms, Guns and Ammo Magazine, and he's the host of the Best Defense on the Outdoor Network. He is an expert, and he will be critical to your evaluation of the evidence in this case. But Tommy Randolph, on that walkthrough video, attempts to cooperate. He answers all of their questions, and he attempts to recall every detail. And he spends hours at that scene with law enforcement a full week later on the 15th of May. Why is that important? Because you're actually going to hear evidence, believe it or not, during this trial that the LVMPD goes back to that crime scene. After the walkthrough, a full week has passed, 35 people are there that night, many people are in and out the intervening week, a hazmat crew has actually come out and done a cleanup, you'll see the carpet cuts out where the blood had been prior, and they go in there and attempt to recreate a crime scene, having already made up their minds about what happened, and attempting to use that as actual evidence. In fact, you'll see and you'll hear from another crime scene analyst by the name of Randy McPhail, who will go through painstakingly and put these little arrows on what he would describe as evidence in this shooting. It's going to be real important. Because that evidence is swabbed, it's impounded. This happened in 2008. They never tested until 2023. And as you sit here today during this trial, they won't even be able to tell you that's blood, and they certainly can't tell you whose blood that is. But here's what they'll tell you. A week later, after the walkthrough, after detectives and 100 other people have been through that scene, they walk in again. They're in a clean garage without the body of Mike Miller. Rocky Albee, the sergeant who can't testify, goes into that garage and he finds two additional shell cases.
See, law enforcement and the state will attempt to tell you during this trial from their perspective what all this evidence means. But there's actually going to be evidence that we don't know how it got there, when it got there, or how it has any relation to the shooting whatsoever. That's the problem with the physical evidence in this case. State also talked to you about a timeline. And I tell you, that's one of the big problems in Tommy Randolph's case. Law enforcement's decided Tommy's responsible, so they take pieces of evidence, or their interpretation of evidence, to establish a timeline based on their perspective. And they do it, as Mr. Hamner told you, with one perspective of a video. That Funny's gas station video. They tell you a specific time that car leaves a pump. I want you to pay attention during trial, because you're going to see on that video an entirely different perspective. It tells you that their timeline is inaccurate. They're going to give you an estimate of driving time, while not including certain facts that you're going to have to know when you make this important consideration. They're going to talk to you about Mark Bartlett. His testimony is going to be critically important in this case, but not for the reasons Mr. Hamner told you. He's going to tell you things that are going to let you know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that that timeline he mentioned is wrong, and that 911 call. They're going to talk to you about things on that 911 call and ignore others, a different perspective that's going to let you know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that timeline is inaccurate. As Mr. Hamner says, there's a problem with the state's timeline, and it's the actual evidence that you're going to hear during this trial. I tell you, there's a problem with the relationship that Tommy had with Mike Miller. There is. They've gotten large parts of that story wrong from gossip from third parties and in ways that we will be able to demonstrate to you are completely inaccurate. And life insurance. They're going to tell you that's the motive for Tommy Randolph to commit this crime. There's a problem. Tommy Randolph did not and could not ever take out a life insurance policy on someone else. You can't do that. The person that's insured has to take out the policy. And you'll see that it was Sharon Randolph who got life insurance, that urinated in a cup, that gave blood samples, that signed contracts, life insurance on her life. There's a problem with that theory from the state. It's the evidence. See, here's the deal, ladies and gentlemen. This case really is about perspective. The state will call witnesses and they will present evidence to show you their perspective. That there is one murderer in this trial and that there are two victims. The state would have you believe that Mike Miller is a victim along with Sharon Randolph. The problem with that, ladies and gentlemen, is the actual evidence. And when you look at the case, when you've seen the evidence, when you heard the evidence, and you look at it from the perspective of that evidence, you will know there is but one murderer. His name is Mike Miller. And there's actually two victims. Mike Miller victimized Tommy Randolph. When he entered his home, he took his possessions, and he took his wife from him. Mike Miller murdered Sharon Randolph, and he did it in cold blood. And when you look at the evidence in this case, from the evidence perspective, you will know that Tommy Randolph is not guilty.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that will be the conclusion of the opening statements in this case. State, are you prepared to call your first witness?
You're listening to Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph. There's more raw courtroom drama ahead as we bring you unfiltered audio from trial. Join us as we navigate the testimonies, the tension, and the truth behind the headlines. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a minute. More Dark Vows, the trial of Thomas Randolph, next.